special on the Discovery Channel, and Claire was some kind of paranoid housewife with nothing better to do than smear the reputation of the man who had spent his every waking moment trying to please her? Claire looked at the orange prescription bottle on her desk. Percocet. The top was off because she'd already taken one. Paul's name was on the label. The directions said, "Take as needed for pain." Claire was certainly in pain. She used the tip of her finger to topple over the bottle. Yellow pills spilled onto her desktop. She placed another Percocet on her tongue and washed it down with a sip of wine. Suicides ran in families. She had learned this during a class on Hemingway taught by an ancient professor who seemed himself to have one foot in the grave. Ernest had used a shotgun. His father had done the same. There was a sister and brother, a granddaughter, maybe others whom Claire could not recall, but she knew that they'd all died by their own hands. Claire looked at the Percocet spilled across her desktop. She moved the pills around like pieces of candy. Her father had ended his life with an injection of Nembutal, a brand of pentobarbital used to euthanize animals. Death by respiratory arrest. Before the injection, he had swallowed a handful of sleeping pills with a vodka chaser. It was 2 weeks before the 6-year anniversary of Julia's disappearance. He'd had a mild stroke the month before. His suicide note was written in a shaky hand on a torn-off sheet of notebook paper. "To all of my beautiful girls, I love you with every piece of my heart. Daddy." Claire recalled a long-ago weekend spent at her father's dismal bachelor apartment. During the day, Sam had done all the things that recently divorced fathers do with their children. Bought her clothes he couldn't afford, taken her to a movie her mother had forbade her to see, and let her eat so much junk food that she'd almost been comatose by the time he'd finally brought her back to the sickly, pink room with pink sheets that he'd decorated especially for her. Claire had been well past her pink years. Her room at home was painted robin's egg blue, with a multicolored wedding quilt on the bed, and absolutely no stuffed animals but one, which she kept sitting in the rocking chair that had belonged to her mother's father. Around midnight, the hamburgers and ice cream had commenced an ungodly battle inside Claire's stomach. She had run to the bathroom, only to find her father sitting in the tub. He wasn't taking a bath. He was wearing his pajamas. He had his face buried in a pillow. He was sobbing so uncontrollably that he barely noticed when she turned on the lights. "I'm sorry, sweet pea." His voice had been so soft that she had to bend down to hear it. Oddly, as she'd knelt by the tub, Claire had imagined that this was what it might be like one day when she bathed her own children. She'd asked, "What is it, Daddy?" He'd shaken his head. He wouldn't look at her. It was Julia's birthday. He had spent the morning at the sheriff's office going through her case file, looking at photographs of her old dorm room, her bedroom at the house, her bike that sat chained outside the student center for weeks after she was gone. "There are just some things you can't unsee." Every argument between her parents featured some variation of Helen telling Sam to just move on. Given the choice between her seemingly cold mother and her broken hull of a father, was it any wonder that later in life, Claire's court-appointed therapist had accused her of not being forthcoming with her feelings? Her father overflowed with feeling, You couldn't stand near him without absorbing some of the sorrow that seemed to radiate from his chest. No one who looked at him saw a whole human being. His eyes were perpetually weepy. His lips trembled from dark thoughts. He had night terrors that eventually got him evicted from his apartment complex. Toward the end, when Claire would stay with him, honestly, when her mother forced her to stay with him, Claire would lie in bed and press her hand to the thin wall between their bedrooms and feel the vibrations as her father's screams filled the air. Eventually, he would wake himself up. She would hear him pacing the room. Claire would ask him through the wall if he was okay, and he would always say he was okay. They both knew this was a lie. Just like they both knew, she wouldn't go in there to check on him. Not that Claire was completely heartless. She'd checked on him dozens of times before. She'd run into his room with her heart in her mouth and found him writhing in bed with the sheets tangled around him. He was always embarrassed. She was always conscious of how useless she was to him, how Helen should have really been there. But this was the reason that Helen had left in the first place.
"Kind of makes me love your mom less to hear that,"
Paul had said when Claire finally told him what life was like after Julia. Paul. He had always been Claire's biggest champion. He always took her side. Even the day he'd bailed her out of jail when everything that had happened was clearly a shitstorm of her own making, Paul had said,
"Don't sweat it. We'll get a lawyer."
18 years ago, Lydia had told her that the problem with Paul Scott was that he didn't see Claire as a normal, imperfect human being. He was blind to her faults. He covered her missteps. He would never challenge her or scare her or infuriate her or stir up any of those fiery emotions that made it worthwhile to put up with a man's bullshit. "Why are you saying all of that like it's a bad thing?" Claire had demanded, because she was desperately lonely, and she was tired of being the girl whose sister had disappeared, or the girl whose sister was an addict, or the girl whose father had killed himself, or the girl who was too pretty for her own good. She wanted to be something new, something that she chose to be on her own. She wanted to be Mrs. Paul Scott. She wanted a protector. She wanted to be cherished. She wanted to be clever. She certainly didn't want someone who made her feel like the ground could shift under her feet at any moment. She'd had quite enough of that in her early life, thank you very much. Besides, it wasn't like Lydia had found a better alternative. She thrived on insecurity. Every part of her life had been tied up in being popular. She'd started taking pills because all the cool kids were into them. She'd snorted coke because a boyfriend told her that all the fun girls snorted coke. Time and again, Claire had watched her sister ignore the nice, normal guys so she could throw herself at the flakiest, best-looking assholes in the room. The more they ignored her, the more she wanted them. Which is why it was not surprising to Claire that, a month after they had stopped talking to each other, Lydia had married a man named Lloyd Delgado. He was very handsome in a snaggle-toothed kind of way. He was also a cokehead from South Florida with a series of petty arrests on his record. 4 months after they married, Lloyd was dead of a drug overdose, and Lydia had a court-appointed guardian assigned to protect her unborn child. Julia Katie Delgado was born 8 months after that. For almost a year, they lived in a homeless shelter that offered daycare. Then Lydia got a job at a vet's office cleaning cages in the back. Then she got promoted to grooming assistant and was able to afford a hotel room that she rented by the week. Dee went to private preschool while Lydia skipped lunch and sometimes dinner. After 2 years as an assistant, Lydia got promoted to head groomer. Almost a full year later, she was able to buy a reliable car and rent a one-bedroom apartment. 3 years after that, she opened her own grooming business. At first, she would go to clients' houses in a dilapidated Dodge van with red duct tape for taillights. Then she got a better van and turned it into a mobile grooming venture. 8 years ago, she opened her own storefront. She had 2 employees. She had a small mortgage on a small ranch house. She dated her next-door neighbor, a man named Rick Butler, who looked like a younger, less sexy version of Sam Shepard. She had several dogs and a cat. Her daughter attended Westerly Academy on a scholarship arranged by an anonymous donor. Well, not really anonymous anymore, because, according to the paperwork Claire had found in Paul's office, he'd been using a shell organization to foot the $30,000 a year for Julia D. Delgado to attend Westerly Academy. Claire had found Dee's scholarship essay in the same set of files along with 30 other entries from students all over the metro area. Obviously, the contest was rigged, but Dee's paper was remarkably cogent compared to the others. Her thesis dealt with how difficult the state of Georgia made life for convicted drug felons. They were denied food and housing assistance. They couldn't vote. They faced employment discrimination. They were denied scholarship opportunities. They often had no family support system. Considering they had served their time, paid their fines, completed parole, and paid taxes, didn't they deserve the right to full citizenship like the rest of us? The argument was compelling. Even without the benefit of the photographs Claire had on her desk in front of her. And thanks to the private detectives Paul had hired to track Lydia over the years, there were plenty of photographs for Claire to choose from. A frazzled-looking Lydia carrying Dee in one arm and a bag of groceries in the other. A clearly exhausted Lydia standing at the bus stop outside the vet's office. Lydia walking a pack of dogs down a tree-lined street, her face relaxed for a brief moment in time. Climbing into the beat-up Dodge van with the red tape on the taillights. Behind the wheel of the Ford van with the mobile grooming equipment inside. Standing proudly in front of the new storefront. The photo was clearly taken on grand opening day. Lydia was using a giant pair of scissors to cut a yellow ribbon while her daughter and hippie boyfriend proudly looked on. Dee Delgado. Claire put the pictures in order. Lydia's child looked so much like Julia that it took Claire's breath away. Paul must have thought the same thing when he saw the photographs. He'd never met Julia, but Claire had 3 scrapbooks full of family photos. She wondered if it was worth putting them side by side and doing a comparison. And then she worried that she hadn't opened the scrapbooks in years, and if she did so now, would she find something that told her Paul had looked at the scrapbooks too? She decided there was no way he hadn't. Clearly, Paul was obsessed with Lydia. Every September for the past 17.5 years, he'd hired a private detective to check in on her. He'd used different agencies each time, but they had all delivered the same type of detailed reports, cataloging the minutiae of Lydia's life, credit reports, background checks, tax returns, court orders, parole reports, court transcripts, though the legal side had dried up 15 years ago. There was even a separate note detailing the names and types of animals she owned. Claire had had absolutely no idea that he was doing this. She imagined that Lydia was likewise clueless, because she knew without a doubt that Lydia would die before she took one red cent from Paul. The funny thing was that, over the years, Paul had occasionally suggested that Claire try to get in touch with Lydia. He'd made noises about how he wished he had family left he could talk to, how Helen wasn't getting any younger, and it might be good for Claire to heal old wounds. Once, he'd even offered to try to look for her. But Claire had said no, because she wanted to make it clear to Paul that she would never forgive her sister for lying about him. "I will never let another person come between us," Claire had assured him, her voice shaking with the righteous indignation she felt on behalf of her wrongly accused husband. Had Paul manipulated Claire with Lydia the same way he'd manipulated her with the computer passwords and bank accounts? Claire had easy access to everything. So, she felt compelled to look for nothing. Paul had been so very, very cunning, hiding all of his transgressions in plain sight. The only question now was, how many more transgressions was she going to find? Claire stared at the two heavy file boxes she'd carried down from Paul's office. They were made of a milky white plastic. The outside of each box was labeled Personal 1 and Personal 2. Claire couldn't bring herself to go through the second box. The first had contained enough hell to end her day on. The file folders inside were color-coded. The tabs were neatly labeled with women's names. Claire had zeroed in on Lydia's for obvious reasons, but she had closed the box on the dozens of other files that had dozens of other women's names because she had already glimpsed quite enough of Paul's personal shit. She could not force herself to go looking for more. Instead, she opened the flip phone by the overturned Percocet bottle. Claire had bought a pay-as-you-go cell phone, which she knew was called a burner phone, at least if you could believe Law and Order. Lydia's cell phone number was in Paul's reports. Claire had sent her a text from the burner. There was no message, just the Dunwoody address. Claire had wanted to leave it up to chance. Would Lydia dismiss the address as a scam, something along the lines of a deposed Nigerian president seeking her bank details? Or would she dismiss it when she realized it had come from Claire? Claire deserved to be ignored. Her sister had told her that a man had tried to rape her, and Claire's response had been to believe the man. And yet, Lydia had texted back almost immediately, "I'm on my way." Since the robbery, Claire had been leaving the security gate open. She had secretly hoped the burglars would come back and kill her. Or maybe not kill her, because that would be cruel to Helen. Perhaps they could just beat her senseless so she could go into a coma and wake up a year from now when all of the dominoes had stopped falling. Here was the first domino. It was easy to say that a person who watched films of rape was not necessarily interested in real-life rape. But what if there was an instance in that person's past when someone had accused him of trying to commit that very crime? Second domino? What if that long-ago attempted rape accusation was true? Third domino. Statistically, rapists didn't just rape once. If they got away with it, they generally kept raping. Even if they didn't get away with it, the recidivism rate was so high that they might as well put a revolving door on every prison. How did Claire know this statistic? Because she'd volunteered at a rape crisis hotline a handful of years ago, which would have been a hilarious bit of irony if someone had told her this story at a party. Which brought her to the fourth domino. What was really inside the Pandora's boxes labeled Personal 1 and Personal 2? Any thinking person could guess that the files with women's names were exactly like the file with Lydia's name. Surveillance reports, photographs, detailed lists of the comings and goings of women that Paul had targeted. Fifth domino. If Paul had really tried to rape Lydia, what had he really done to the other women? Thank God she had never had children with him. The thought made her head spin. Actually, the whole room was spinning. The wine and pills were not playing well with each other. Claire was feeling that familiar, overwhelming sickness again. She closed her eyes. In her mind, she made a list, because writing things down felt too dangerous. Jacob Mayhew. Was he lying about the authenticity of the movies? In keeping with his mantle of the hard-boiled detective, was he the type of man who would lie to a woman in order to protect her delicate feelings? Adam Quinn. What files did he really want? Was he as good as Paul had been at hiding his true nature, even when he was having sex with her? Fred Nolan. Why was this creepy asshole really at the house the day of the funeral? Was it because of the movies, or did he have something worse waiting for Claire around the corner? Paul Scott. Rapist? Sadist? Husband, friend, lover, liar? Claire had been married to him for almost half of her life, but she had no idea who he really was. She opened her eyes. She looked down at the spilled Percocet and contemplated taking another. Claire didn't understand the appeal of being drugged. She had thought the purpose was to make you numb, but, if anything, she was feeling everything much too intensely. She couldn't shut down her brain. She felt shaky. Her tongue was too thick for her mouth. Maybe she was doing it wrong. Maybe the two volumes she'd taken an hour ago were counteracting the effects. Maybe she needed more Percocet. Claire took her iPad out of her desk drawer. Surely she could find some kind of instructional video posted by a helpful drug addict on YouTube. The burner phone vibrated. Claire read Lydia's message. I'm here. She pressed her palms on the desktop and pushed herself up. Or at least, she tried to. The muscles in her arms wouldn't respond. Claire forced her legs to stand and nearly fell over when the entire room made a quarter turn to the left. The doorbell rang. Claire shoved all of Lydia's photos and reports into her desk drawer. She took a sip of wine, then decided to take the glass with her. Walking came with its own challenges. The wide-open spaces of the kitchen and family room presented few obstacles. But she felt like she was inside a pinball machine as she bumped against the walls in the main hallway. She finally had to take off her heels, which she'd only left on because they always took off their shoes inside the house. All of the rugs were white. The floor was bleached oak. The walls were white. Even some of the paintings were muted whites. She wasn't living in a house. She was occupying a sanitarium. The handles on the front doors telescoped out of her reach. She could see the outline of Lydia's body through the frosted glass. Claire spilled her wine as she grabbed at the door handle. She felt her lips smiling, though none of this was particularly funny. Lydia knocked on the glass. I'm right here. Claire finally pulled open the door. Jesus Christ. Lydia leaned in to look at Claire's eyes. Your pupils are the size of dimes. I don't think that's possible, Claire said, because surely a dime was larger than her entire eyeball. Or was it closer to a quarter? Lydia came into the house without being asked. She dropped her purse by the front door. She kicked off her shoes. She looked around the entrance foyer.
What is this place?
I don't know, Claire said, because it didn't feel like home anymore. Did you have an affair with Paul? Lydia's mouth dropped open in surprise. Just tell me, Claire said, because she knew from Paul's reports that Lydia had had a child and that Paul was paying for the girl's education. An affair that produced a love child was so much more palatable than all the other terrible explanations for why Paul would insert himself into her sister's life. Lydia still had her mouth open. Did you?
Absolutely not.
Lydia looked worried.
What did you take?
Nembutal and Ambien with a vodka back.
That's not funny.
Lydia snatched away the glass of wine. She looked for somewhere to put it in the stark entryway and settled on the floor.
Why did you ask me that about Paul?
Claire kept the answer to herself.
Was he cheating on you?
Claire hadn't framed the optics through that lens.
Was it cheating to rape someone? Because to be clear, that's the direction in which all the dominoes were falling. If Paul had truly tried to rape Lydia, then he had probably tried and succeeded with someone else. And if he had gotten away with it once, then he had probably tried again. And hired a private detective to follow them around for the rest of their lives so that he could still exert control over them from his lair over the garage. But was that cheating? Claire knew from her training at the crisis center that rape was about power. Paul certainly liked controlling things. So, was raping women the equivalent of turning all the cans in the pantry label out, or loading the dishwasher with mechanical precision? Claire! Lydia snapped her fingers very loudly. Look at me!
Claire tried her best to look at her sister. She'd always thought that Lydia was the prettiest of all of them. Her face was fuller, but she'd aged more gracefully than Claire would have thought. She had laugh lines around her eyes. She had a beautiful, accomplished daughter. She had a boyfriend who was a recovering heroin addict who listened to talk radio while he worked on an old truck in his driveway.
Why did Paul need to know that? Why did he need to know anything about Lydia at all? Was it stalking if you hired someone else to do it? And wasn't watching someone without their knowledge another form of rape?
Lydia asked,
Claire, what did you take?
Her voice softened. She rubbed Claire's arms.
Sweet pea, tell me what you took.
Valium?
Claire suddenly wanted to cry. She couldn't remember the last time someone had called her sweet pea.
Some Percocet.
How many?
Claire shook her head because it didn't matter.
None of this mattered.
We had a cat named Mr. Sandwich.
Lydia was understandably perplexed.
Okay.
We called him Hammy. Like ham in a sandwich. He was always between us. On the couch, in the bed. He only purred when we were both petting him.
Lydia tilted her head to the side, like she was trying to understand a crazy person.
Cats know people.
Claire was sure her sister understood this. They had grown up surrounded by animals. None of them could walk through a parking lot without attracting a stray.
If Paul had been a bad person, Hammy would have known,
Claire knew she was offering a weak defense, but she couldn't stop herself.
Isn't that what you hear? That bad people hate animals?
Lydia shook her head in confusion.
I don't know what you want me to say, Claire. Hitler loved dogs.
Reductio ad Hitlerum.
Claire couldn't stop quoting Paul.
It's when you compare someone to Hitler to win an argument.
Are we arguing?
Tell me what happened between you and Paul.
Lydia let out that heavy sigh again.
Why?
Because I've never heard it before.
You wouldn't let me tell you before. You refused to listen.
I'm listening now.
Lydia glanced around the foyer, making the point that Claire had barely invited her past the front door. What her sister didn't understand was that Claire could not bear the thought of seeing the cold, soulless house through Lydia's eyes.
Please, Claire begged. Please, Pepper, tell me.
She threw up her hands, as if to dismiss this entire exercise as not worth her time. Still, Lydia said,
We were in his car, the Miata. He put his hand on my knee. I slapped it away.
Claire realized she was holding her breath.
That was it?
You really think that's it?
Lydia sounded angry. Claire supposed she had every right to be.
He kept driving. And I thought, okay, we're just going to ignore that my sister's loser boyfriend put his hand on my knee. But then, he took a turn onto a road I didn't know. And we were suddenly in the woods.
Lydia's voice had gone soft. Instead of looking at Claire, she was staring over her shoulder.
He pulled over. He turned off the engine. I asked him what was going on, and he punched me in the face.
Claire felt her own fists clench. Paul had never hit anyone in his life. Even in the alley when he was fighting the snake man, Paul hadn't managed to land a punch.
Lydia said, I was dazed. He started to climb on top of me. I tried to fight back. He punched me again, but I turned my head.
She turned her head slightly. An actor trying to convince the audience.
I reached for the door handle. I don't know how I managed to get it open. I fell out of the car. He was on top of me. I brought up my knee.
She paused, and Claire remembered a self-defense class she had taken. The instructor had drilled it into them that you couldn't count on disabling a man by kneeing him in the groin, because it was more likely you would miss the mark and piss him off even more.
Lydia continued. I started running. I got about 20, maybe 30 feet away before he tackled me. I fell flat on my face and he got on top of me.
She looked down at the floor. Claire couldn't help but wonder if she was doing it to look more vulnerable.
I couldn't breathe. He was crushing me. I could feel my ribs bending like they were going to break.
She put her hand to her ribs.
And he kept saying, Tell me you want this.
Claire felt her heart stop mid-beat.
I still have nightmares about the way he said it. Whispering. Like it was sexy. When it was just so fucking creepy.
Lydia shuddered.
Sometimes, I fall asleep on my stomach and I'll hear his voice in my ear and...
Claire opened her mouth so that she could breathe. She could almost feel the flex in her own ribs from when Paul had pressed her into the brick wall. He had whispered, "Tell me you want this," into Claire's ear. She'd thought it was silly at the time. Paul had never talked to her like that before. But he hadn't let up until Claire had said the exact words back to him. She asked Lydia, "What did you do next?" Lydia gave a half shrug.
"I didn't have a choice.
I told him that I wanted it. He ripped down my pants. I still have scars on my leg where his nails gouged the skin." Claire put her hand on her own leg where Paul had scraped away the skin.
"And then?"
He was undoing his belt buckle. "I heard whistling, like really loud whistling. It was a couple of guys. They were walking in the woods, and they thought we were making out. I started screaming for my life. Paul jumped up. He ran back toward the car. One of the guys chased after him, and the other helped me up. They wanted to call the police, but I told them no."
"Why?"
"I'd just gotten bailed out of jail for the billionth time. Paul was an upstanding grad student with two jobs. Who would you believe?" She knew whom Claire had believed.
"The two guys?"
"Were gay men looking for a hookup in a South Alabama forest. The cops would have known that the minute they opened their mouths." She shook her head at the futility of it all. "And I didn't really care about me at that point. My only concern was getting him away from you." Claire put her hand to her forehead. She felt feverish. They were still standing in the foyer. She should have invited Lydia in. She should have taken her to her office and sat with her.
"Do you want a drink?"
"I told you I'm in recovery."
Claire knew that. Paul's detectives had sat in on Lydia's meetings and recorded her every word.
"I need a drink."
Claire found her wine glass on the floor. She swallowed the dregs in one go. She closed her eyes and waited. There was no relief. Lydia asked, "Do you have a problem with drugs and alcohol?" Claire struggled to return the glass to the floor.
"Yes.
The problem is that I don't like them very much." Lydia opened her mouth to respond, but light filled the entryway as a car came up the driveway.
"Who's here?"
Claire turned on the video keypad by the door. They watched the screen as a black Crown Victoria parked at the mouth of the front walkway.
"Why is a Huckleberry here?"
Lydia sounded panicked.
"Claire?"
Claire was grappling with her own panic. She was more worried about which Huckleberry it was. Mayhew, come to make sure she hadn't made copies of the movies? Nolan, with his inappropriate remarks and creepy looks and maddening questions that gave no explanation as to why he was here in the first place? Or was it her parole officer? He had warned Claire that he could turn up and drug test her without notice. She told Lydia,
"I'm on parole. I can't have drugs in my system."
Claire's thoughts raced against the Valium. She remembered another detail from Paul's files. Back when she was using, Lydia had pled guilty to a felony drug charge in order to avoid a prison sentence. Claire tried to push her down the hallway.
"Pepper, move! I'm not allowed to associate with felons. They could take me back to jail."
Lydia didn't move. She was trapped in place. Her mouth worked silently, as if there were too many questions running through her brain to pin down just one. Finally, she said, "Turn down the lights." Claire didn't know what else to do. She pressed the ambient button on the keypad. All of the lights on the ground floor dimmed, which would hopefully
hide the state of her pupils. They both looked at the video screen, their faces inches apart. Lydia's panic breathing matched Claire's. A man got out of the car. He was tall and solidly built. His brown hair was neatly parted on the side.
Fuck, Claire groaned, because her brain wasn't sharp enough right now to deal with Fred Nolan. It's the FBI.
What? Lydia's voice almost squeaked with fear.
Fred Nolan.
Claire's skin crawled at the sound of his name.
He's an asshole special agent from the downtown office.
What? Lydia looked terrified. Did you commit a federal crime?
I don't know. Maybe.
There wasn't enough time to get into it. Claire switched the video screen to the front door camera. The image showed the top of Nolan's head as he climbed the steps. Listen to me. Lydia kept her voice low. Legally, you don't have to answer any of his questions. You don't have to leave with him unless he arrests you. And if he does arrest you, you don't say a goddamn word. Do you understand me, Claire? None of your bullshit jokes or funny asides. Just keep your fucking mouth shut.
Okay.
Claire could feel her mind clearing, probably from the rush of adrenaline coursing through her body. They both looked at the front door and waited. Nolan's shadow loomed large behind the frosted glass. He reached down and pressed the doorbell. They both flinched at the sound. Lydia indicated that Claire should stay silent. She was making Nolan wait, which was probably a good idea. At the very least, Claire could take the time to get her breathing under control. Nolan pressed the doorbell again. Lydia lifted her feet and made a walking sound. She opened the door a crack and stuck out her head. Claire could see her on the video screen. She had to look up at Nolan because he was so tall.
Good evening, ma'am.
Nolan tipped an imaginary hat.
I'm here to speak to the lady of the house.
Lydia's voice still sounded squeaky and afraid.
She's sleeping.
She's not standing behind you?
Nolan pressed his hand against the door until Lydia had to open it or fall over. He smiled at Claire. The bruise around his eye had started to yellow.
Funny thing about frosted glass. Doesn't really hide anything.
Lydia asked, What do you want?
Well, that's a loaded question.
Nolan kept his hand on the door so Lydia couldn't close it. He looked up at the night sky. There was no shelter over the front porch. Paul had said it would ruin the line of the house. Nolan said,
Looks like the rain's passing.
Claire and Lydia didn't respond.
Me? I like the rain.
Nolan stepped inside the house. He glanced around the entryway.
Great time to sit back and read a book or watch a movie. You like movies?
Claire tried to swallow. Why was he talking about movies? Had he spoken with Mayhew? Was there a tracker on the computers? Claire had used Paul's laptop to access the Wi-Fi. Had Nolan monitored all of her activity?
Mrs. Scott.
Claire managed to take a shallow breath. She forced herself not to ask him point blank if he was here to arrest her.
That your truck out there?
Lydia stiffened. Nolan was talking to her now. He held out his hand. He didn't have to reach far. He was standing so close to Lydia that he barely had to bend his elbow.
We haven't been introduced. Agent Fred Nolan, FBI.
Lydia didn't shake the offered hand.
I could get your parole officer over here.
He was looking at Claire again.
Setting aside that knowingly and willfully lying or materially misleading a federal agent is punishable by 5 years in prison, you're technically not allowed to ignore your PO's questions. Terms of your parole. No right to remain silent. He leaned forward and studied Claire's eyes. No right to get stoned. Lydia said, My name is Mindy Parker. The truck is a loaner from my mechanic. I'm a friend of Claire's. Nolan gave Lydia a careful once-over, because Lydia didn't look like one of Claire's friends. Her jeans were more spandex than denim. Her black T-shirt had a bleach stain at the hem, and her gray cardigan was raveled at the edges as if an animal had chewed on it. She didn't even look like the housekeeper of one of Claire's friends. Mindy Parker. Nolan made a great show of pulling out a spiral-bound notebook and pen. He wrote down Lydia's fake name. Trust but verify. Isn't that what Reagan said? Why are you here? Lydia demanded. It's almost midnight. Claire's husband just died. She wants to be left in peace. Still wearing her funeral clothes. Nolan let his eyes travel up and down Claire's body. Not that you don't look great in them. Claire smiled reflexively, because that's what she always did when she was complimented. Nolan said, I'm wondering, Mrs. Scott, if your husband's business partner has been in touch. Claire's mouth went dry as salt. Mrs. Scott, has Mr. Quinn been in touch? Claire forced herself to answer. He was at the funeral. Yeah, I saw. Nice of him to be there, considering. He pitched up his voice in a bad imitation of Claire.
Considering what, Agent Nolan?
No, please call me Fred. Do you mind if I call you Claire?
No, not at all, Fred.
Claire made her expression as hard as she could. Nolan said, I'm assuming you knew your husband was embezzling money from the company. Claire felt her mouth open in surprise. She had to repeat Nolan's words back in her head before she could divine their meaning. Even then, she couldn't believe what the man was saying. Paul was mind-numbingly fair with money. She'd once suffered through a 30-minute round trip when he'd realized a cashier at a country store had given him too much change. She told Nolan,
You're lying.
Am I? Claire wanted to slap his smug face. This was some kind of trick. Nolan was working with Adam and Mayhew. Or he was working on his own, and all of it had something to do with those wretched movies. Whatever game you're playing, it's not working.
Ask Adam Quinn if you don't believe me.
Nolan waited, as if Claire would run to the telephone.
He's the one who called in the feds. One of the company accountants found a $3 million wire into a shell company called Little Ham Holdings.
Claire clenched her jaw shut so she wouldn't scream. Little Ham had been another one of their nicknames for Mr. Sandwich.
Nolan said to Lydia, That's a lot of money, right? $3 million? People like you and me, we could retire on that.
Claire's knees felt weak. Her legs were shaking. She had to get Nolan out of here before she had some sort of nervous breakdown.
I want you to leave.
I want my wife to stop fucking my neighbor.
Nolan chuckled as if they were all in on the joke.
You know, Claire, the funny thing is that kind of dough is a drop in the bucket for a guy like your husband,
he told Lydia.
Paul's worth $28 million on paper, or was worth that much. How much is the insurance policy you have on him?
This question was for Claire, but she didn't answer because she had no idea.
Another $20 million, Nolan provided. Which means you're worth almost $50 million now, Widow Scott.
He paused to let the information sink in. But Claire was past the point at which she could make sense of anything. Nolan said, It was nice of Adam Quinn to settle out of court instead of letting me toss your husband into the federal pen.
He gave Claire a lecherous look.
I guess he found his own way to get your husband back.
The implied insult knocked her out of her stupor.
What gives you the...
Shut up, Claire.
Lydia stood directly in front of her. She told Nolan, "You need to leave."
Nolan smiled his crocodile smile. Do I?
Are you here to arrest her?
Should I be?
Number one, back the fuck away from me.
Nolan took a very deliberate step back. I can't wait to hear what number two is.
It's this, asshole. If you want to interrogate her, then call her lawyer to set it up.
Nolan smiled like a gargoyle. You know what, Mindy Parker? Now that I'm looking at you, I'm thinking you look a lot like Claire. It's almost like you two gals could be sisters.
Lydia didn't let him get to her.
Get the fuck out.
Nolan held up his hands in surrender, but he didn't give in.
It's just curious, you know. Why is it that a guy worth all those Benjamins steals $3 million from his own business?
Claire felt a sharp pain in her chest. She couldn't breathe. The ground was moving again. She reached for the wall behind her. She had felt the same way yesterday when she'd fainted. Nolan said,
Well, I'll let you ladies get back to enjoying your evening.
He stepped out onto the porch and looked up at the night sky.
Sure is a nice night.
Lydia slammed the door. She bolted the French lock. She covered her mouth with both hands. Her eyes were wide with fear. They both watched the video display as Fred Nolan shuffled his way down the stone steps and slowly made his way to the car. Claire looked away. She couldn't watch anymore, but she couldn't stop hearing him. The soft click of his car door opening, the loud bang of it being closed, the rumble of the car's engine, the mechanical groan of the power steering as he turned around and drove back down the driveway. Lydia dropped her hands. She was breathing as hard as Claire.
What the fuck, Claire?
She stared at Claire with open shock.
What the fucking fuck?
Claire had lost the fuck 2 days ago.
I don't know.
You don't know?
Lydia was practically screaming. Her voice echoed off the polished concrete floors and bounced up the metal and glass spiral staircase.
How the fuck can't you know, Claire?
She started pacing back and forth across the entryway.
I can't believe this. I can't believe any of it.
Claire couldn't believe it either. The movies, Mayhew, Nolan, Paul's collection of folders, the ones she knew about, the one she couldn't force herself to read. Whatever was going on with Adam Quinn. And now she had been told that Paul was a thief. $3 million? Nolan's estimate of Paul's net worth was off by several million. He'd only quoted what was in the bank. Paul didn't believe in the stock market. The house was paid off. The cars were paid for. There was no reason for Paul to steal anything. She laughed at herself, because that was all she could do.
Why can I believe that Paul is a rapist, but not a thief?
The question stopped Lydia cold.
You believe me. I should have believed you years ago.
Claire pushed herself away from the wall. She felt the guilt of dragging Lydia into this mess. She had no right to jeopardize her sister, especially after all that had happened.
I'm sorry I asked you to come here. You should go.
Instead of answering, Lydia looked down at the floor. Her purse was a brown leather bag the size of a feed sack. Claire wondered if Paul had a photo of her buying it. Some of the pictures had obviously been taken with a telephoto lens, but others
were close enough to read the text on the coupon she always used at the grocery store. Lydia could never find out about Paul's surveillance. Claire could at least do that for her sister. Lydia had a 17-year-old daughter whose school tuition Paul was anonymously paying. She had a boyfriend. She had a mortgage. She had a business with 2 employees she was responsible for. Knowing that Paul had been there every step of the way would destroy her. Claire said,
"Pepper, really, you need to go. I never should have asked you to come here."
Lydia picked up her purse. She hefted the strap over her shoulder. She put her hand on the door, but she didn't open it. "When's the last time you took a shower?" Claire shook her head. She hadn't bathed since the morning of Paul's funeral. "What about food? Have you been eating?" Claire shook her head again. She didn't know how to explain it. They had taken a cooking class a few months ago, and Paul wasn't half bad. But now, every time she thought about her husband in the kitchen holding a knife, all she could think about was the machete from the movies. "Claire?" Lydia had obviously asked her another question. Her purse was back on the floor, her shoes were piled where she'd left them. "Go take a shower. I'll cook you something to eat."
"You should go," Claire told her. "You shouldn't get involved in this. I don't even know what it is, Liddy, but it's bad. It's worse than you could ever imagine."
"So I gathered." Claire spoke the only truth she was certain of.
"I don't deserve your forgiveness."
"I don't forgive you, but you're still my sister." Chapter 8. Lydia had texted Rick that she would be home in an hour. She would make sure Claire was bathed and fed, and then she would stand over her sister while she called Helen to come take care of her. Lydia had filled in for her mother 24 years ago, and she wasn't going to do it again, especially with the FBI involved. Just the thought of Fred Nolan made her nerves pulse with fear. The man obviously knew things about Paul that Claire did not know. Or maybe Claire knew them, and she was just a very good actress. In which case, was Claire lying when she said she finally believed Lydia about Paul attacking her? If she wasn't, then what changed her mind? If she was, then what was her motivation? There was no figuring it out. All the sneakiness her sister had exhibited as a child had been honed to adult perfection, so that Claire could be standing right in front of an oncoming train and still insist that everything was going to be fine. Actually, the more Lydia interacted with this adult Claire, the more she understood she hadn't grown up to be a mother. She had grown up to be their mother. Lydia stared blankly around the kitchen. She had thought that cooking Claire something to eat would be the easy part. But as with the rest of the house, the kitchen was too sleek to be practical. All of the appliances were concealed behind shiny white laminate doors that looked so cheap they had to cost $1 million. Even the cooktop blended in with the polished quartz countertop. The whole space was part kitchen showroom, part Jetsons. She couldn't imagine that anyone would actually choose to live here. Not that Claire was doing much living. The refrigerator was filled with unopened bottles of wine. The only food was a half carton of eggs that expired in 2 days. Lydia found a new loaf of bread in one of the pantries. There was also a coffee machine, which Lydia only recognized because there was a label on it that said, "Coffee Machine," followed by what she assumed was the installation date. The laminated set of directions beside the machine was clearly Paul's handiwork. Lydia knew that her sister couldn't be bothered to do something so tedious and stupid. She pressed various buttons until the machine whirred to life. She slid an espresso cup under the spout and watched it fill.
"You figured it out," Claire said. She was dressed in a light blue button-down shirt and faded jeans.
Her hair was slicked back to dry.